This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. We're sitting down with Rob Magner of Magic Air Tours up at Orcas Island, which is in the San Juan Islands, that are north of Seattle and Puget Sound. And Rod runs scenic flights in an old Travelair biplane, which is a pretty unique way to make a living. And Mike happened to run into him when he was up here and called me up, so we came up to check out what's going on and how Rod got into this business. So, Rod, when did you first get interested in flying?
Actually, when I was a kid, my dad was an aeronautical engineer for Northrop and worked on the flying wing and so forth. So I grew up reading Aviation Week and having up with a bowl of Wheaties every morning and always wanted to fly. So I started gliders when I was 14.
Oh, wow.
And soloed in a Cub when I was 16, got my license in high school at age 17. My dad brought home a newsletter from Republic Aviation, and we were on Long Island at the time. And I found out you could join a glider club for $25 as a student. And so, and my dad's, one of the guys that worked for my dad was the head of the club, German guy. So we basically, I went down every weekend and helped him launch the gliders and stuff. And in return, I got some free instruction. And just couldn't get enough to get soloed up, you know, so I went over to Zons Airport in Long Island and learned to fly the Piper Cub.
Okay, cool.
Then after I got my license in high school, and then after that, after college, I went to Michigan on a Navy scholarship, and I ended up flying 5 years for the Navy. Flew A-4s, Foxtrots, and then A-7s.
Okay.
We had some T-28s. And it was during the Vietnam War, so I flew in that. It's actually in the same squadron McCain was, but it was after he was shot down, so I never knew him.
Right. Did you keep flying through college, too?
Or was it? Yeah, actually, I worked for a Cessna dealer.
Okay.
So I had keys to the place, and I could go fly. And I got the Navy paid for 35 hours of flight time senior year. So I could go down and fly at night and do whatever I wanted, so it was great. Still, I only had about 150 hours when I graduated from college. But
yeah, I just want to dig into the Navy training a little bit, because I always wanted to fly for the Navy. Then my eyes went bad, so I ended up not. So you went into Navy training. You're flying. What planes did you start training in?
I started in a T-34.
Okay.
Same
okay.
as a Bonanza.
Okay.
Tandem seat.
Okay, I was thinking of a different plane.
Got about 20 hours in that. And then we went right straight to jets in Meridian, Mississippi, in the T-2A. Came back to Pensacola in the T-2B, which was a twin-engine version of that. Did our care quals in that. And then did my advanced jet training in the Cougar.
Oh,
the
yeah.
old F-9, which was a centrifugal flow jet engine, which was a dog. But that was in Beeville, Texas. And oddly enough, I had some people from Beeville just the other day, which told me that they had closed Chase Field in 91.
Huh.
And turned it into a prison camp.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, the Navy training was excellent.
Do you think your background at the gliders and the Cubs helped out with the...
Yeah, if you had too much time before you went in the Navy, it was actually a detriment, because the Navy has a way of indoctrinating you. Everything has to be by the book, very, very precise.
Right.
When you come aboard the carrier in an A-4, you had 10.5 feet of hook to ramp clearance. You had to be on speed by, you know, plus or minus a knot or two at the max.
Right.
Otherwise, you'd miss all the all the wires. So that flight training was outstanding, and that carries through. I mean, landing this Travelair when I first got it was just as challenging as a carrier landing, because of the tendency to want to swap ends.
Yeah, a little
and crosswinds and things, and tail
ground looping.
We cured that. I've added disc brakes and toe brakes to it.
And, made it have heel brakes?
It had heel brakes. We got field approval for the disc brakes. That was an STC for the, it's called red line brakes. And the toe brakes, and we got field approval on all that. So made
cool.
it extremely manageable. I can handle it in a really good crosswind. I don't generally fly in a lot of crosswind, but you got to be prepared. So
right. So when you were done with the Navy, you'd flown a bunch of different jets. Did you continue flying?
Actually, not I did, but just on a piecemeal basis. I used to give glider rides for a friend of mine in Texas. We moved. I was going to fly for Southwest Airlines.
Okay, yep.
Joined Southwest Airlines, and at the time, back in the late 70s, I'd never heard of them because they were fairly new. And I called his buddy up, and he said, "Yeah," he says, "I made captain in 3 months." And I thought he was flying a Metroliner or something. He says, "No, 737. It was all inside Texas." The truth of the matter, when they started flying outside of Texas, as they grew, he couldn't stand it because it was too long a flight.
Right, too boring. Too far from home.
But he liked going up and down, landing and taking off all day long. It was like a small squadron. He was number 40 on their seniority list.
Wow.
So he got the promise of the job for me, and I went and got the type rating along with another buddy of ours from the Navy. And then the recession came along, and they didn't hire for about a year and a half, and I missed the class. And then a new chief pilot came in, and he didn't want as many military pilots and so forth. So I ended up in my own business, which had nothing to do with flying, but I was making more than I would as a co-pilot.
Right.
Weekends I was out giving glider rides. My son was, he soloed in a glider when he was 15.
Oh, cool.
And so I chased him around a little bit. And I did fly. I was offered a couple jobs with flying King Airs and stuff. But,
right, corporate type.
Out in West Texas, but I didn't want to live in West Texas. So Dallas was already too hot. So
you're living in Texas now.
We were living in Dallas. We moved to Dallas because I was supposed to start with Southwest in October of 79.
Okay, so this is all in the 80s, and yeah, the airlines kind of stopped
hiring. Yeah, they were just starting to boom then, you know.
Yeah, they boomed, and then they kind of, I mean, Eastern went out of business.
Well, Southwest, you know.
Well, they kept booming.
They never stopped.
Yeah, they're still booming.
They've done really well. If you had invested with them, with the stock splits and stuff, you'd be, you know, maybe make millions.
Yeah.
And I would have enjoyed that. I've actually, the key to, for me to, for flying was I wanted to be master of my own destiny.
Right.
And in the Navy, you really weren't.
Right.
And if I'd flown for the airlines, I probably wouldn't, I wouldn't have felt that way either, except by the basis of seniority. But here, I am master of my own destiny.
So, yeah, so obviously you kept interested in aviation. You got your kids into it, your son into it. And then at some point you decided to start up in San Juan's with the biplane. Did you get into the biplanes prior to that, or was starting this business your first foray into the biplane?
I had not owned a biplane. This is actually the first and only airplane I've ever owned.
Okay.
So we've been together 22 years.
And it's a 1929 Traveler.
Yeah, it's a 29 Traveler 4000. Originally it was a 2000, which had an inline OXX6 engine on it.
Okay, yeah.
Radiator hanging down below.
That's like the Jennies.
What's that?
The Jennies had those, right?
Yeah. Similar. Had dual ignition, which was a big factor back then. This airplane's actually had five different types of engines on it.
Oh, wow.
The Continental that's on there now, the 220, has been on there since 47. I have two engines. We rotate them through every 1,000 hours.
Rebuild them.
And have them rebuilt. They're good, strong engines. They're also put in tanks, which a lot of people don't know.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that at all.
You can buy a tank engine and use parts. Can't use the tank engine on the airplane, but a lot of the parts are interchangeable.
Oh, that's cool. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Huh. So, yeah, to start this business then, you'd had a successful business, non-aviation business.
Right.
And I'm guessing that you did this as kind of a part-time job in the summers when you first thought of it, or was it?
No, I wanted to make it full-time.
Okay.
I mean, you can only do it in the summers, but the business I had in Texas was pretty much a seasonal business as well, and I could make enough in the summers there to put enough nuts away to survive through the winter.
Cool.
Plus my wife worked, so that helped.
Yeah.
And a lot.
Stretches through the lean times.
Oh, yeah. And so I had two sons, and we decided, I came up here in the mid-80s to visit my friend, Richard Bach, and I decided this is where I wanted to be. I want to get out of the heat from Texas, and Richard and I were old friends, so he encouraged me to come up, and we did. And
were you guys friends from the Navy?
No.
Or?
I met Richard. I actually produced a show called The Philosophy of Flight. in 1976, January. And it was a deal where we had moved from Ann Arbor, Michigan to California, to Moraga, California. Hmm. And there was an empty theater in Moraga, in Ream Valley, which was 1,023 seats. And I saw at the Safeway store, and I saw a magazine cover that Richard Bach had made a film called Nothing by Chance, out of the book Nothing by Chance, yep. And Hugh Downs had produced it. And I really wanted to see that. And my son, I was originally supposed to go to a lecture that Richard was going to give in Seattle, or in San Francisco. But my second son, Ryan, was going to be born on the same day, and I didn't want to spend the money for the ticket because I knew I was going to be there for the birth. Turned out, he was born on that particular day. They canceled that show because they couldn't sell enough tickets. And so it was about 2 months later when I saw that magazine cover, and I put two and two together, and I called San Francisco State, got Richard's agent's number, and I found out what it cost to hire him and so forth. Huh. And the theater was empty. Nobody was using it. I found out what it cost to rent that, and I just decided to put on my own show. And I got all the films that I'd never seen that I wanted to see that I figured everybody else would want to see.
Of course.
Blue Angels, The Threshold was a brand new film. Nothing by Chance was a feature-length film, which was spectacular. And then all these speakers. So I had Chuck Yeager. I had three different shows, but had can't think of his name.
Until you got to meet Chuck Yeager. I've never met him.
Well, yeah, I actually had Chuck Yeager and Bob Hoover. I had dinner with them for the second show. Art Scholl was the guy I was trying to think of. Art Scholl was at the first show. But basically, it was from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. scheduled. And it was nonstop.
Huh.
And I had a caterer come in with sandwiches and stuff. So it was a picnic inside of a 1,000-seat theater. And it was the most comfortable theater west of the Mississippi at one point, because every seat rocked back and forth. So to make a long story short, I had no idea whether I was going to make money or lose money, but I ended up turning away about 200 people at the door. And the tickets were $15. So I made money, and we did two more shows later. But because of that, I became good friends with Richard, and later on, it was kind of ironic in a way. It was funny because I had a good friend of mine I graduated from Michigan with who had gone to Harvard, MBA student, and he wanted me to move back to Fort Wayne, Indiana to help him with a business there that was a Muncie Aviation Corporation thing. Anyway, I said, I'll go back and take a look, but I don't think I want to move back to the Midwest. So I had gotten back from Fort Wayne the day before, and I got a phone call from Richard. And he says, would you be interested in helping me promote my book, Illusions, when it came out?
Huh.
I said, when's that? He said, about a year. And I said, tell me something about it. And he said, well, it begins in the mystical hills east of Fort Wayne. I said, oh, really? So I thought, well, I can position myself there. So, yep, so that worked out perfectly. And I did set up the tour for the book, which became a bestseller for 2 years. we did 2 weeks, barnstorming to the Midwest. He had his fleet, and I borrowed from the factory, I borrowed the Great Lakes.
Okay, So you guys were flying we're barnstorming around the Midwest in old biplanes.
We went and landed in fields and camped underneath the wings. And
just like the book.
We also stayed in motels and got showers.
It wasn't as
rough as it was that, but it was
so
very
much
successful. The weather was great, and we had a great time.
So that was your first intro to the biplanes. Barnstorming, which is kind of what you're doing now too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of.
Well, that was we didn't sell any rides that trip. But we did carry a lot of media people, guys in the front seat of my Great Lakes, and we did air-to-air stuff and so forth. Did a lot of TV, radio interviews. Plus, I set up two talks.
Okay.
We filled up the 1,000-seat theater in Fort Wayne one night, and then also in Champaign, Illinois.
Cool.
It was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun. So
I bet. So is that when you first started thinking about starting your own?
Well, this business was kind of interesting. I came here. I was going to work with Richard and another company. And we just came here without you know, only the promise of something to do.
Right.
But we wanted to be here, so that was the key thing. And this, a good friend of mine who had been to the San Juans and was who knew Ernie Gann, who lived on San Juan Island.
Yep, yep.
And we've done a show together down at the Gamage Auditorium called The Wings of Dreams. Actually, we called it Philosophy of Flight. And then Woody had done another one called Wings of Dreams and Flying Machines, same place. And I called Woody and I said, you got to come up to the San Juans. He said, ah, I've been up there before. I said, you know, San Juan Island. I said, no, it's not the same. You got to come to Orcas. So he came up here, saw it, fell in love. He bought himself a big place right on the water. And Woody had a business where he restored old airplanes. He restored one for John Denver, a number of other people, Wacos and so forth. And so I was sitting with Woody one evening, just the two of us at his house, having dinner. And at the time, when I first came here, I ended up working for a small airline charter company, doing all their marketing and so forth. And I said, if you just give me a 182, I could do scenic rides and have a lot of fun. And the guy could never see his way to that. So, and I was talking with Woody, and I just said, you know, I'm going to buy a 182 and start doing scenic rides.
Right.
And he said, no. He says, you got to buy my old travel air. And I had been with him when he bought it. And in Tucson, and because I was working with Woody down there in the Phoenix area, Scottsdale. So, long story short, Woody says, you got to buy it. And I said, all right. So I found an investor partner because it was $130,000.
Oh, wow. Yep.
Most anybody ever paid for a traveler.
So he didn't give you
like a company deal. But I knew it was perfect. Yeah. I knew it was absolutely perfect. Woody restored an airplane by parking the old airplane and building a new one, transferring the data plate. And it was 50% stronger than the original.
It was a new airplane.
Every
basically.
Wire, drag wire inside the wings is perfect. Had to be. And so it only had 186 hours on it.
Huh, wow.
And it was finished in 84. So I ended up buying it with my partner, financial partner, 1991. Blew it up here. Just followed I-5, didn't have any, all I had was a compass, 17 and a half hours of flying, and stopped in the Bay Area at Buchanan Field, gave my dad a ride. He was my first passenger,
cool,
which was kind of nice, and then ended up here, and 2 days later I started selling rides, May 1st, 1991.
Uh-huh. What was the paperwork process with the FAA? Are you part 91?
It is part 91, and... at the time, I didn't know what to charge.
Okay.
It was kind of we were lost, really. But a good friend of mine, a good friend of Richard's also, was Stu McPherson, who gave me my first biplane ride years before. And he was a dentist, but he was only charging $30 for a ride for about 20 minutes. We decided, we'll charge 50% higher, you know, we'll fly a little longer. And so I flew, 1,200 people the first summer.
Oh, wow. Two people.
It was nonstop. I mean, it was amazing. But at $45 a piece. And we looked at the numbers and said, you know, this is great, but we need to make more money.
Right.
So this is I tracked everything on an Excel spreadsheet. I can tell you, and I had everybody sign a logbook. Just a commentary logbook, but I treat it as a business, but it's it's really a passion.
Right.
But I have to. I do. I'm the only guy. It's just me, the biplane, and the two of us. Trying to make people happy. That's all.
Yeah, and you're just up here for the summer.
We live here on Orcas, and but I can't fly during the winter. I mean,
right.
I put a sign on the door. It says. If the weather's smiling and it's over 45 degrees, give me a call. But otherwise, I'm not coming down.
Oh, it'd be darn cold.
And but below 45, there's no heater, so below 45 is too cold.
Yeah.
But I've done some rides on New Year's Day and Christmas and so forth. But primarily, it's July and August. You really have a window of about June 15th to August 15th.
Okay.
Kids get out of school. Kids go back into school. That's when people travel. And that's when your bulk of your business. So I'm open 7 days a week during that time. Only fly in good weather, though.
And you're on your own schedule, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you show up here. I mean, I imagine you show up, but you know, in the morning.
The weather's people bad. Want to know that you're going to be there.
Yeah.
But I don't have any set hours. But I'll come in between 9 and 10 every day. Right. And I was here yesterday. It rained all day. I had 3 rides scheduled. Figured it's on Saturday, and it's right at the prime part of the year now. I probably would have done, 5, 6, 7 rides yesterday.
Cool.
Did 0 because of the weather, but I was still here. Met Mike in the process. Also had sold 2 rides. People walked in.
Fantastic.
Later, and, so it pays to be here even in the when you can't fly. But I don't mind being here. It's just.
Looking at your hangar, it's a place you want to.
Yeah.
It's a good place to hang
out. When the door is open, it's like a. A big picture frame window on the world. You can watch eagles going by. Sometimes a P-51 will go right by, eye level. Bill Anders, the astronaut's got a hangar across the field. Used to fly the 51 in and out of here.
But with your plane sitting right there, that's like a postcard.
Yeah, the airplane, it's sometimes it's amazing.
Yeah.
And we used to have a little farm across the road here where you could go pick your own corn.
Oh, wow.
Or tomatoes or whatever.
Yeah,
so I go over to Lavender's farm. Walk across the street, pick 3 ears, put them in the microwave, and sit here and have lunch. It was fabulous. I mean, it's still that way, really, but the farm's gone. But
this area certainly drew a lot of well-known aviators. You got Ernie Gahn.
Some of the best aviation writers that have ever written about flying have lived here. Richard is one, and Ernie Gahn is the other. There's another fellow on San Juan Island, Rick Drury.
Okay,
Who's written a couple of books, and his... One was called My Secret War, Richard Drury.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
He used to write for an aviation magazine for airlines. He was a FedEx pilot, started out at Flying Tigers.
Okay.
And he wrote a fabulous column at the end of this magazine every month for quite a few years.
Cool.
And so we've had some really good aviation writers around here for
Definitely.
Sure.
But Ernie Gahn started painting at the end of his career, too, I think.
Yeah, he was over there. He lived there for 25 years. I met him one time. He actually flew for one of the airlines here, too.
I didn't know that.
Just for fun, a little while.
Excellent.
Not much. But his wife, Dodie Gahn, still lives over there and still flies.
Oh, fantastic.
So she's actually flown with me.
I was just noticing you got a bunch of tools behind your desk. Do you do your own maintenance? Or?
I have a mechanic lives across the runway for me over here. I had a couple of good mechanics over the years. That's a key. You got to have somebody. I mean, I can change oil and do lots of things legally myself.
Yeah.
But you got to have an excellent mechanic with a round engine guy that knows understands them.
And is that the key? Just the radial engine. The rest of the plane, I'm guessing, is pretty basic mechanically.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Yeah, the rest of the airplane is standard fare. Fabric covered, steel tube fuselage. I've got a Scott tailwheel.
Oh, wow.
3200
okay.
tailwheel.
Yep.
The engine, the Continental, is the same thing that's on the Stearman. And there's lots of parts around. There's getting a little more scarce. But for years, until about 3 years ago, I had... Jack Lanning do my engines, and he was 30 miles south of me here in Arlington, and he had his own travel air, and all he did was build travel airs and restore engines, Continentals, and Lycomings. And hang on a second.
Yep, no worries.
Ride. and the engine, I've had really good luck with the Continentals, but Jack did a spectacular job when he overhauled those, and he would help install them. And if I had a problem, I could fly it down to, Arlington, 35 minutes away.
Yeah.
So it was like having the factory, which closed in 1931, 30 miles away, because he knew everything about the airplane. In addition, so
that works very. That works well.
It worked out great.
Do you know of many other people who do this kind of?
Yes, I do. There's more than there used to be. When the Wacos came out with the Waco YMF-5, a lot of guys tried to do it with that. We considered buying one of those, but they were, almost twice as expensive.
Right.
And they're a lot smaller in the front cockpit. This has a lot more room in it.
Okay.
There's a fellow that...
You can put two people in the front
seat. I can put two people in the front seat, side by side, which makes it really... makes it work, because
right.
you can charge enough to make a living at it.
And people, you'd think a lot of them would want to go. They're well, here with their...
A lot of people want to go in twos.
Right,
I always thought that having a Great Lakes would be a good airplane. And Rick tried to do that in Friday Harbor. There was a significant weight limit on the front seat in that airplane, and lots of people just want to go together. It's kind of romantic.
Yeah, I was going to say, you probably get a lot of couples.
Yeah.
I would think. But these islands are kind of romantic. A lot of couples come up here on, you know.
Well, it's the marriage capital of the state, I think.
Oh, is it?
Lots. I've actually had 15 marriage proposals done in the airplane.
Oh, but you haven't had 15 personally.
Not yet. Just had one that was successful, so
that's the way to do it.
But and the only one that was unsuccessful was an older couple. She just couldn't hear him. I almost said something. I thought, no, I don't want to interfere with fate.
Yeah,
and I'll tell you the funny story about that.
Then work it out.
I always know in advance usually, but that they're going to do that. And so the guy wrote. I have a logbook. Everybody signs, and the fella signed the logbook. He says, "I proposed to her, but she didn't hear me." And
so I'm a free man.
In fact, she told him to shut up because he was interfering with her looking at all the stuff on the ground. And so he told her later, he proposed to her later in the evening down at Smuggler's Villa off the end of the runway here. And she said, "I don't believe you." So he emailed me and said, "Can you copy the logbook and so I can prove to her that I did actually propose in the airplane?" And so I did, and they lived happily ever after. So
cool.
But, it's been, the first one was the guy took a lawnmower and mowed a message in a field, and I had to circle about three times because most of the time it's upside down, right?
Right. Yep.
But that still worked out. And let's see, there was one other one. There was one that I didn't know. The guy didn't tell me he was going to do it. I just kind of suspected it. To mention on that flight that I, you know, had about a dozen or more proposals done in the airplane, but I told her, I said, "Don't worry," I knew that they weren't married, and that's and he did propose to her. And I didn't.
He
know
felt it. Like he had to. At
I
that
didn't
point.
Know it until later, you know, when I got back.
He's like, he kept nudging him. Come on,
it's a lot of fun.
Do you do the same? Having done a few tours, I know a lot of tour companies will have actually these published routes they fly. Do you do a sort of the same route every time, or you?
Well, I do generally pretty much the same, but I vary it depending on my whim and the weather. Sometimes there's some clouds obscuring part of it or something. I try to maximize what I'm going to show them. there's 176 islands up here, but there's four major ones. So I do a big triangle with lots of little twists and turns along the way. And by doing that, I can tell them about, you know, who lives down here, or this particular runway on Shaw, which was built by they used to fly Hellcats in and out of there. And at the, if you stand at the top of the runway, you can't see the bottom. There's a 100-foot drop, and they used to fly underneath the power line with these Hellcats and Corsairs. And they actually had dogfights with the guys dropping bombs on one of the other islands called Flat Top, which is named after a carrier nickname. And they used to come by and tease him, you know, draw this guy out, and he'd come out of here in a cloud of dust. And have, so I tell these stories, all of which I've heard since I've been here.
Yeah.
You know, plus I've read the history books about the islands. And so you can really, you can talk for nonstop from the moment you get in the airplane. Mm-hmm. You know, I always, welcome to my magical flying machine.
Yeah.
And if you want to pretend it's 1929, you can, because really from the air, you can't tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And you set the tone and the mood. I tell them all about the airplane, give them all the facts and figures, but you know, I like to make them laugh if I can, and make them relaxed. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
Because usually out of a couple, one person is nervous.
Right.
And so I always, you know, I just tell them. I said, "This flying is a gift. If you're ready for it, it's your time. I'm not going to twist your arm." And I said, "But this is like riding in an old Buick convertible, and I can promise you, my goal is to inspire you and show you how beautiful flying really is. And I can almost promise you'll come back with a permanent smile."
Yeah.
And
so it's
so.
it's about more than just the flight.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's about the people you're flying up there and giving them a positive experience.
I had to get this because I couldn't remember. I can't remember exactly what it said, but years ago they produced an artist's catalog, a list of all the artists on the island in San Orcas. And they said, tell us what you do. And most people were legitimate. They put in there. Some carpenters said I'd do this, that, that thing. So I decided to put my own thing in there, and I said nothing about the biplane, but this is what I wrote. I said, my whimsical aero sculptures include the elements of cloud, wind, water, G-force, music, and folklore, and a delicate yet powerful ephemeral performance which disappears as it is created, yet is never forgotten.
Huh.
And I didn't say anything. It was in 2000 I wrote that. And that actually is my philosophy about the whole flight.
Huh. Do you have any inclinations to be an aviation writer?
Well, I always thought I would, but there's so many other good ones out there.
Yeah.
I've written a lot of stuff, but it's mostly for myself. I have three pedal planes here, one of which I built, which is called Little Magic.
Oh, cool.
And the travel air is called Magic One, because I think flying is magical. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a double meaning, because in my squadron, in the Navy, we were Magic Stones, and Magic was the call sign. Mm-hmm. And if you were leader of the flight, it was Magic One.
Okay.
But I really mean it truly in the sense that flying is magical. Mm-hmm. And so I take little magic. It looks just like the big one, but it's a pedal plane. And I've taken it all over the place with... photographed it next to B-47s in yeah. Seattle. And
cool.
So we were going to write a book called Little Magic's First Adventures Away from the Hangar. But it ended up being, it wasn't a children's book. It was all about the philosophy of life and flight and love so forth. So.
Well, just like Jonathan Livingston Seagull, it's not really a children's book.
Right,
even though
exactly.
It,
yeah, same thing.
Yeah.
I sent a draft of it to Richard. He loved it, but that was years ago, and I still haven't gotten around to finishing it. So... It's in the works, I guess, but I'm not sure when it's going to be done.
Someday.
Maybe
someday
when I retire.
Yeah, maybe someday when you're done with the flying part of it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So you've gone from jets in the Navy to old biplanes. That's a pretty good stretch of airplanes to jump into.
Yeah, it gives you, starting with gliders was a great introduction to flying, because it gave you a lot of confidence.
A lot of take basic skills.
Yeah, I mean, it was... You can land this airplane. You don't have to have an engine.
Yeah.
The Navy gave you some technical flying skills. There were some beautiful moments also flying. And the contrast between flying with and dropping bombs on people, but with a beautiful sunset in the background.
Yeah.
That never quite made sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just felt like the thing about the Vietnam War for me was that it was such a waste of time. We were risking our lives, and the only reason most of the guys that I was flying with wanted to stay over there was because there was American troops on the ground.
Right.
But it was basically a contest between the Air Force and the Navy, see how many sorties, what the sortie count was. And all you had to do to get credit for the Navy was to fly off, launch off the bow with a full load of bombs, whether you dropped them on a target or in the water.
But you weren't going to land.
It didn't matter. Yeah, you couldn't land.
Yeah.
But that counted as a sortie. And so it was the sortie race was between the Air Force and the Navy. And there was times they would launch us when there was just no way you could get back aboard the ship.
Right.
We had a couple times when, the whole flight had to, 16 or 20 airplanes had to go into Da Nang or Chu Lai or something.
Huh.
And
you're just getting those numbers ratcheted up.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you'd be sitting on the deck. We had an attitude gyro that was like a ball. AJB3 it was called. And you'd be tied down, and you could watch this attitude gyro just rotate like this, back like you're flying an airplane, pitching it up and down. And one time, the F-8s were in the back of the boat, and the skipper of the F-8 squadron was in the back, and his tailpipe sticking out over the tail end of the ramp of the carrier. And he calls the air boss and says, "Boss," says, I know I can get off this boat, but I don't know if I can get back. And they hear the air boss going, "Yeah, we're checking right now." And you hear all these mics go click, 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 click. Everybody's agreeing with them, launch, fortunately, but you know, we've had launches, lots of launches where they have to wait for the bow to come up. Otherwise they fire you right into the water.
Right.
You know, it's pitching up and down. And when you came back aboard ship, you had 10.5 feet of hook to ramp clearance on an ideal glide path. And sometimes the deck was at night was pitching 16 feet. You know, and so you said, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And again, you're not master of your own destiny.
Yeah.
You're not in charge of things. You always thought somebody knew more than you did about what was going on with
or
the war.
You hope they did.
Yeah. Well, you find out that they really don't, right. Obviously.
Yeah.
Even the astronauts talked about that. So that's when I determined I really wanted to be my own boss for the rest of my life.
But it seems like with this job, you've kind of achieved the, you've got your love of flying and you're your own boss.
Yeah. It's nice. When you work for yourself, you have to be self-motivated person.
Right, yeah.
You don't have to do everything right, but you have to make every landing perfect, you know?
Right.
You got to maintain the airplane. If something goes wrong with that airplane during the middle of the day, and you're grounded for 2 or 3 days, during the middle of the summer, that's going to cost you, $1,500 to $2,000 a day.
Yeah. Can be your whole season.
Right. You got to make sure that everything is stay ahead of the game and understand it enough to do that. And not overtax yourself and so forth. You got to have people that you can count on to come and fix the airplane if it needs it, so it's a challenge that way. And I do have a spare engine, so I could always put this engine back on if that one really was a problem of some kind.
Right.
I could put this one back on there. That's the biggest thing, is to have the spare engine. And you got to have some spare
cables,
cylinders, all the parts that need for brake pads, and you name it,
Yeah.
But that's not that difficult, ultimately. It's just the biggest challenge, honestly, is trying to decide not to fly. I'll give you one example. My wife was here that day. I was doing rides, and the wind was picking up, and I decided on the last approach that was enough. It wasn't that much of a crosswind, but it was just getting really violent.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I'm holding on to the stick firmly with my gloved hand, and I said, well, this isn't fun anymore for me or for my passengers. So I taxied in, and I had a whole group of people here. It must have been 12 people. Mm-hmm. And I said, sorry, we're going to have to wait until the wind dies down. Oh, no, come on, chicken,
Yeah.
A lot of pressure. And there's a lot of pressure, too, to fly when you can't make a distinct call.
Right.
Because it's... not quite there. Not that much crosswind, but and the temptation is because if it's going to cost you $300 or $500 or whatever it's going to be, so you got to forget about the money. Just say, doing it safe. So those people particularly, they looked out the door and they watched. They said, watch this next guy land. It was a Cessna. And he almost crashed. They said, okay, we believe you.
Yeah, especially it's probably You've got a tail dragger more susceptible.
Yeah, I don't. There was one time when I first started the business, I took off and I learned what my crosswind limits were.
Right.
I had one guy who wanted to go, and as I taxied out, I looked at the windsock, and it was 90 degrees stanced straight out. And that was before I had these disc brakes and toe brakes. And I thought about it, and I said, let's go. And I actually took him up, and I wave soared Mount Constitution, 2,400 foot mountain over here. It was so windy. And I said, I kind of gulped and said, okay, let's go for it. I didn't tell him, but I said, we're going to go in and land. I shot 3 approaches. I just, worked my way down the runway until I could get a smooth point to land. And it wasn't until the 3rd approach that I got it.
I
put it down and stuck it on there. When you land this thing, you stick the nose. I do wheel landings exclusively.
Uh-huh.
It's a hard surface runway, 3,000 feet. Got plenty of runway, but it's stick forward, glue it, put a negative angle attack on it, and keep it on the, down on the runway. It's when the tail comes down that you got to start worrying about the crosswinds. And in the old days, I couldn't get on the brakes right away because they were Bendix brakes and they were horrible.
Right.
And you'd have to take your foot off the pedal, the rudder pedal, to get the heel brake that was so far away.
Yep.
And then you were just, it was just brakes, and then you were worried. So when we added the disc brakes, the guy that did the work for me, he said, I don't think you're going to like these. They're not powerful enough. And I said, well, let me try it. You know, and I said, these are perfect. I can stand on the brakes, and I cannot flip it on its nose.
Right.
But I can steer it perfectly in a crosswind. And so I think I have the best brake system of any traveler in the world.
Cool. Yeah, if you're right, they're too strong, you'd actually flip it over.
Yeah, it rolls, you put it on its nose right away.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I have to hold them real hard for a run-up. But
right.
They're wonderful brakes.
And you're losing, when your tail starts dropping, you're losing the airflow over the tail, which means you're losing some rudder effectiveness.
Right.
That's why
yeah.
you start.
And this airplane's very heavy in the tail.
Okay.
And they like to, any kind of gust will just swing it one way or left or right real quick. So.
Yep. I had an old Luscombe that had heel brakes. That was, I'm not fond of them either.
Yeah,
you got to get all goofed around on your pedals.
Well, there's controversy about whether you should do a 3-point, and that sort of thing. I don't worry about the controversy. I just land. I've made 9,000 landings here.
Yeah.
And only two that I couldn't feel. That was when it was hydroplaned,
Yeah.
It really greased it on. It was wet. It rained while we were gone. It just greased it on. I didn't. And it was down before I realized it. That's all. But it was rare. But you can... You can grease it on, and then I get on the brakes if I want to right away. But I always have my feet up on the brakes, and if a gust comes along, I can just tap that brake at the same time I hit the rudder, and it solves the problem.
Right, just straightens it right out.
Yeah. So,
cool.
I'm happy.
Yeah.
I would have had a lot more gray hair than if I
if you kept the old brakes.
Right.
Yeah, I'd like to save some of that for the walk around. I'd love to get a video of the plane.
Sure. If somebody's ever interested in starting a biplane ride, the thing that I, it doesn't matter where you do it. People want to do it. Last few years, especially since that movie, The Bucket List.
Oh yeah.
Everybody's got this on their bucket list, and that's not gonna, that is not really going to go away, because they're going to be fewer and fewer biplanes around to do this with. The FAA may get more particular about it, different things too, so you never know. But there will always be enough people, as the population increases, that wonder what's it like to fly an open cockpit. And this is the ideal way to do it. But from a business perspective, you have to be very realistic about how much you got to make. And when people ask me about the price, if they do, I just tell them I have to average... these days, $550 an hour to stay in business.
Okay.
I charge $299 for plus tax, and I track everything. I don't care if I ever want to sell the business. I can tell you to the penny what I made over the last 22 years. I don't hide it from the IRS, kind of thing.
Right.
People pay you in cash. I do take MasterCard and Visa and Firstborns, but. I think, I've seen a lot of guys try to start a business like this. If you're not there very often, if you're there part of the time, it's not going to work. You got to be there, at least in this situation. Now, I don't go to other venues. I stay right here.
Right.
There's enough people that come to the island. It takes 5,000 people on a ferry boat for me to get 5 rides.
Wow.
There's a lot of people that are too afraid of flying, or one of the persons doesn't want to go, so they don't, the only hassle that you have really is, besides the weather, which you can pretty much ameliorate just by only flying in good weather,
right?
Is if you get two really big people and they want to fly together and you just can't put them together.
Yeah.
So I split the ride. I do twice as much work, but as long as you have a happy customer, it doesn't matter if it's one or two. You try to do the same ride for everybody.
Yeah. It sounds like even though your own boss, it's a job.
Yeah. I mean, everybody that's comes in is your boss, really.
Right,
in effect.
Yep.
And but the satisfaction is that they will always come back. And, I mean, I have some people fly with me every year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
I've flown people now who they bring their grandkids back. You know, yeah. People that got married are bringing their kids back.
I was going to say some of the proposals. And
I mean, you stay in the same place long enough. I just tell people who live on the island, there's only 4,800 people on the island. I said, if I stay here long enough, everybody will have flown with me, you know, and that's the goal.
Cool.
And but, you know, you just have to be, you have to like people.
Right.
You have to enjoy making people happy. And that's what gives me the greatest satisfaction. I've actually had people in tears because I play this Pavarotti. And the music goes up and down. It's kind of this beautiful song. And all you have to do is a few turns left and right, almost not quite a wing over, do these things with the music and point out, you know, look down the wing and you'll see this beautiful yellow wing. And the wing, the light is bouncing back and forth between the wings, especially in the lower lower after, you know, afternoon type thing.
Yep, yep.
And it is the most incredible thing to see it. And then up close to a cloud or something. I've had people, I've got unbelievable stories about the music and what it did to them. It goes back to what I was talking about, what I read about, you know, this thing. I honestly think of myself as an artist, a lot of times painting my way through the sky. And if you do that, if you think of yourself as that kind of a person, as an artist, an artist is always free,
right,
to create. And so you're creating this thing, this ephemeral experience for people, which you know that they're always going to remember. I get emails from people that said, I had a guy, he flew with me in 91.
Huh.
And he says, I've never forgotten that. And I've always I want to go again, you know. And I mean, I'm still astounded by the reaction that people have to the ride.
Right, yep.
So
yep.
That's one of the reasons I still do it, is because I know that you're doing some good.
Yep.
Plus, I know that you're changing the world in a better way because you're giving them a different perspective.
You know? Right, so different look at it.
You don't have to change the whole thing. You're just one person at a time.
Yeah.
Or two. I tell people it's like Noah's Ark. You're just taking two people at a time. Having a good time.
Cool. Well, excellent. Well, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah,
we appreciate it.
A pleasure. Thank you, guys.
All right.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.